Welcome everyone to episode number 84 of Underserved. With me today in studio is Madhu Rajagopalan, head of engineering at Wellframe. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Madhu, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to have a talk with you.
So way back in the day, like, you weren't really interested in being a computer engineer, were you?
So I was very passionate in kind of like all things, you know, in engineering, things, how things work, electrical in general. And growing up, my brother-in-law was a mechanical engineer, and he was working for one of the nuclear power stations in India. And so I used to visit them in summer, and he actually would take me to the power plant. And I would go in there, and I was always, you know, fascinated by big machines, right? The steam turbines, these big motors and electrical generators. And he would also take me to all the power systems and the grid structure that they had. And so, you know, growing up, I really wanted to like work on and build big machinery. So I actually went to school for undergrad for electrical and electronics engineering in this place called Shanmuga Arts and Science Institute, called like SASTRA now as a short form. Yeah, I was focused on a lot more electrical machinery, power systems and distribution.
So I was Googling and like going on Wikipedia, and I saw that SASTRA had some issues where the government was trying for years to take the land out from underneath them.
Yeah, so this happened after I graduated and I moved over to the United States. I think what happened was, so when they started, the founder had this big land, and then he went to the government, and the government said, yeah, it's a great idea, building this awesome engineering school, use the land you want. And I think they have kind of forgot to get that in writing. And so when the government's changed decades later, they are like, oh gosh, like what are you doing? Like, you, this is not your land. And so I know they had a lot of legal battles and went to the courts. And what last I heard, it was unfortunate. They had to like actually bring down a couple of buildings that they'd built for students. That was very unfortunate.
Yeah, in February of this year, they got an eviction notice, which is kind of a strange thing to give to a university.
Yes, but they're really, really big. I think just lots more students are in there and have great programs now than when I was there a couple of decades ago. I think it's really unfortunate, and you know, the students are the one that are missing out in the end, because if you have to break down some of these facilities there.
Yeah, definitely. So after that, is that when you came to do your master's in the States?
So I was focusing on electrical, right? And I was like actually doing pretty good in my grades. And I think, you know, I used to always just kind of like hang out with some of my computer buddies, and they would be writing cool stuff and show me, but I was not really very attached to it. I would say what changed my mind was one of my classmates for a project. He was working on this cathode ray oscilloscope, right? Like, we use that in our lab to really measure the electrical pulses and all of that. And it's actually, I think it's an expensive equipment. And he was pretty clever at the time, and he built a project to really use some of the transformers, reduce the signal strength, and wrote a program in C. And so he would hook that up to the computer, and he would really kind of get the same output that the cathode ray tubes would display. And I was like just amazed, like, wow, you could do stuff like that. And that kind of piqued my interest. So I you know, kind of learned from what he was doing. And at the time, like, I kind of started learning Visual Basic and Foxbase. I did some cool projects, some side things, just to mainly impress some of the computer students, to just say like, hey, I could also like learn and do stuff.
I can hang with you.
Right. And then I realized at the time, it was also kind of was really the software industry and the services sector in India was just exploding. And like, everybody was getting computer jobs, and there were like so many companies looking for computer engineers, like software in general. And there's not much action going on in electrical, which is like, it's the same scene, nothing changed. And so I realized that, hey, if I'm going to like this and I want to do a job, I might as well just really learn the advanced concepts and go to school to learn that. And that kind of piqued my interest to do a master's in computer science. I came to BU. and actually enrolled in the master's program for computer science.
You succumbed to the siren song that so many hardware developers feel like, oh, I could do this in software as well.
Right.
And it's much easier, and I can do bug fixes and point releases and all this stuff that's so hard in hardware.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the hardware is great. The development cycle is generally longer. It's slightly expensive. Obviously, it's super optimized for what you're trying to do. A computer is kind of cheaper in that if you could do that in a software, right? Right. And as you can see, like, there's so many new software that's replacing some aspect of hardware that used to be, but the level of control that you have in obviously software is, you know, in a much less extent compared to a hardware.
So you come over here, you're living in the Back Bay somewhere, you're going to school at BU. Yeah. What's that like?
It was great. I loved it. I learned a lot more, just the things that I did not know about computer science, like all the way from like algorithms to just a computer, like just figure out how the operating systems work and cryptography, advanced cryptography and all of that. And you know, at the time, like the web services were like really a cool thing. It was like a very innovative concept at the time. So I learned, you know, like how the grid services work. Like, how can you build this distributed systems using like web services? SOAP protocol, COM, DCOM in the Microsoft world, and, you know, remote invocations and all of that stuff. I would say my favorite was algorithms. I really loved the professor, and he would always like kind of just be more, you know, like practical, right? He had a great way about explaining things that was very easy for me to understand and relate to.
What was your toughest project in doing your master's?
I would say it was one of the grid services was the course. It was to build a distributed system. And at the time I was looking for like this kind of this grid services concept, which is the SETI, right? SETI. That was such an innovative concept that you really break down and distribute the problem and let that run by all this crowdsourcing, if you will, right, on user's computer when its computer is not you, right? So I was doing a kind of some research about it and how could we apply that to maybe some other topic. I really underestimated the complexity of doing that and, you know, either just getting the reliable processing from the nodes, but also to really put it into an application. And so we tried to kind of do the similar thing for like a weather pattern and prediction and all the stuff. And it was very academic, I would say. And, you know, there's a lot of concepts that's being researched at the time in similar scale.
I remember SETI, like that was like the big thing, like, oh, instead of running a screensaver, are you contributing to this search for extraterrestrial intelligence? And they take these big data sets coming out of the sky, whether it was light waves or radio waves or whatever, and your computer would parse a little bit of it and try and see whether or not ET was out there.
Yeah, I thought that was such a cool thing to do. I was so like, I used to just like, they had like forums and things and like, you know, how to improve and open source. That was really, you know, like a concept ahead of the time to do this distributed workloads.
So you graduate, what do you end up doing after that?
So my first job was, I was actually a consultant at a company called WebHire. And we were building the web recruiting portal aspect of Yahoo. So it was like, it was pretty cool in that, I mean, at the time, Yahoo was like really one of the big websites, right? It was a large scale. And so I got the opportunity to work on a, you know, like a very high scale distributed system right off the bat. I got a job in writing their kind of data access layer. You know, working on this, you know, COM and DCOM ATL code. And that was kind of most of their websites were built running on IIS. And we were building the distributed system and was using a lot of that using Microsoft foundational classes. MFC was the kind of like the cool thing at the time in Microsoft world. But I mean, even like when I was learning these concepts, because that was not something that I learned at school, I learned C++ and I knew what MFC was and, you know, some of those classes and the libraries that they had built, the data access, right? So we have an application layer that calls this DCOM object that's running on this data servers. I was fascinated. I was like, wow, like, you know, this is like, can you do that? Like, how does this work? And it was rather complicated. Obviously, these days, it's just so much easier to build something like that. It was like just a lot of learning curve, but extremely satisfying.
So you built some cool stuff, but the market's not really cooperating. This is around 2000 and things are starting to get dicey.
Right. It was, it was the peak of dot-com boom happening around us, right? And there's a lot of new things started coming out in like different spaces. And I think Yahoo at the time was trying to boil the ocean. Like they just wanted to do everything, right? And, you know, that's kind of the Googles were heating up. You know, people are moving. There's the Alta Vista search engine.
Yeah, I remember Alta Vista.
And also like there were competitors to them and just in the recruitment space was, you know, I think Monster and a couple of other websites.
Shout out to previous guest and Monster founder, Jeff Taylor.
Oh, right. And so I left because it was a contract gig and I was there for, I think, 6 months or so. I don't know what happened to them after that. I know they either got acquired or kind of like dissolved into a different company.
And where do you end up next?
So I went to the company called Boston Scientific, and they are a medical devices manufacturer. Their flagship product is a stent for cardiac conditions. And so they build these stent that goes into your like heart and to really just relieve any blocks, right? They're really pioneers in that technology. And so I worked in there, kind of I went to their IT and then I moved to their R&D to build some of the technology for their powering the medical devices. And also they were trying to build an entire suite of products, like all the way from the devices that talks to a patient medical system. So they're kind of working across the board on technology on that.
And you're still in the Microsoft stack?
So I kind of focused more on the website. So that kind of like that's where I transformed into more of a full stack engineer. Well, those concepts didn't actually exist at the time, right? But I was kind of like working on the backend systems and our teams were pretty small early, like a couple of other developers that we had, really smart. It was a lot of learning curve. I learned quite a bit on the job. Like, you know, that's when I kind of got exposed to how to build a website in Active Server Pages, ASP at the time, and kind of evolved into ASPX and, you know, all of that cool stuff that Microsoft was releasing. But it was primarily a Microsoft shop.
Yeah, I remember the old .NET 1.0 coming out and everyone wanting to cut over there and get away from COM object registration.
Right. The comma object registration is fun. It's hard to like debug. And I know they've built a lot of this, you know, concepts to do instrumentation and debugging techniques and STL and all of that fun stuff. But it was a little hard to debug when you have a distributed components like that, right? So registering and really going into the MMC consoles and like really playing with it. That was interesting. I think they've developed a lot of cool concepts out of that and new technology was born, but it was really not the best way to build distributed systems.
Yeah, and Microsoft, definitely back then, less so now, had very much a, hey, don't worry about it. We'll handle these details. You don't need to know what's going on under the covers.
Right.
But then something would go wrong under the covers. And you'd be like, no, I need to get at that now.
And yes. And as a software engineer, learning that I always kind of hated when magic happens under the hood. I know these days, you know, there's just all this, I mean, for valid reasons, all this great technologies and libraries, even for UI like React and all this other cool tech really makes, you know, the developers extremely productive because they don't need to worry about the underlying details. But, you know, it makes sense to me. But I'm kind of the one of the guys that I want to like learn every nitty gritty details. And I would like code like, you know, document.getElement by ID and then really just get the DOM element and manipulate because that's how I've learned JavaScript and that's how I, you know, coded. And I know like in that space, the jQuery came out and it really just made it super easy and intuitive to build, you know, JavaScript applications. When I was trying to learn React just to, you know, kind of just understand how this works. And I had a hard time because there was just so much abstracted away. Like there's just so much happening under the hood.
Not worry about what's happening behind the curtain here. The wizard is handling all the updates for you.
That's right. That's right. It makes sense because I think primarily that if you get that right, I can see like how, you know, the developers now need to kind of focus more on adding value, which is building the product and applications and not worry about this underlying infrastructure that, you know, renders a text box on a web page.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's SYRINX.com.
But the thing you did have to worry about is all of a sudden you got laid off there.
That was sad. I loved my job. And I, you know, as I told you, I made great friends there. But I think they, Boston Scientific at the time, got over their head and they spent a, I'd say, a large sum into a project which was not going to take off very well. And so they've decided to kind of let go of most of the team that was working on that R&D project. Timing was bad at the time for me. I was still under, H-1B visa and, the green card was pending and all that stuff. But the problem was it was like December 12th, 15th or one of those days and I got laid off. And it was, the timing was pretty awful. Boston Scientific was really great about it. They gave me a couple of months so, you know, I don't go out of status and find a job and all that. It was hard in that, like, you know, those days, like, just slow, right? Like, especially people don't hire the last 2 weeks of December. And so I really made that a challenge and I was like just all in. I would like attend 3 interviews in a day, like actual in-person interviews or go to place.
Wow.
With actually 3 offers by, I would say, early first week or second week of Jan. So I really put in the work. You know, a couple of, like, you know, one of the companies were Zantas, and I think it was acquired by like another company called Autonomy. There was like really a product that's focused on archiving documents and legal discovery. And there was another company, I think Microsoft acquired them, that was in Andover. And I finally ended up taking a job at the Boston company. They were an investment firm under Mellon, and I was their lead .NET developer role that I got.
Yeah, for folks that grew up here in the United States, they don't realize, like, if you're coming over here from another country, you need a visa to work. B, like, the most popular one for software developers is the H-1B visa. And if you're lucky enough to get in here, then you got to stay here. And to stay here, you got to be continuously employed.
Right.
Like, if you all of a sudden aren't employed, you can go out of status and get booted out of the country.
Oh, yeah. That's tough for any immigrant to handle that situation because, you know, as I started, I graduated here, I wanted to work and, loved the land of opportunity like everyone and any other immigrant that comes into the United States. And really situations like this, you don't have enough heads up. You know, you have family here, you might have, invested here, like you might have a house and kids. And it's really hard to handle a circumstance like that.
That's scary. But you find a place to land for a little while, but don't end up spending a whole lot of time at Mellon?
Yeah, so Mellon was, it was an interesting, because I did not know what to expect. It was financial services and things were kind of in a different pace. The way they built software and released was not only the pace, but kind of like the things that you were developing was not really what I had expected. And I was commuting from Mall Road to Boston at the time, and I had like a terrible commute. And, you know, a couple of my buddies went to this company called Iron Mountain. And that was just like so close to my house. And I was hearing great things about them. And so I kind of reached out, like, and one of them actually referred me to Iron Mountain. You know, as you know, Iron Mountain has this large storage company, and they kind of store a lot of these, literally the paper documents for mostly like, you know, regulated companies where they have to keep these documents for a certain number of years. I would say it's a headache for companies to do that by themselves because of the storage, making sure they're secure. And also they have tapes, right? We have digital records that you know, you have to archive. And that was just a lot of work.
Making sure you retain them for the right amount of time, making sure you destroy them on time. If there's a legal hold, like, yeah.
It's yeah. I think it's a fantastic model business to be in because, you know, obviously they, you know, you have to pay to protect and pay to destroy. So you get in, get out, you got to like pay money either way.
It's like the Hotel California. Like once those boxes check in, you know, it feels like they never leave.
That's right. That's exactly right. It may be like cheaper to actually keep it than getting rid of them. I don't know. But so I actually joined a team called Technology Escrow. And that was like, I've never heard that concept existed before then. So what the Technology Escrow is basically, you know, you are a company that you are in need of a software and you go to the software company, say, hey, I'm just going to buy your software, but I want to make sure like if you run out of business, I still have the access to the software because it's really important to the client. And so what they end up doing is they would take the software and give it to a company like Iron Mountain and say, hey, Iron Mountain, just keep the software safe. We trust you. You cannot give this to anyone else. You cannot even give it to the client as long as we are in business. And I think some agreement is made by the client and the producer to pay for that. So we actually had some interesting code on our system. You're not supposed to look at them, right? And so we had different like encryption and formats, and we maintained. But I've heard that, you know, we had some exciting code under control.
And so if any of those software vendors ever like declare Chapter 7 or something, now the person that was buying that software can get access to the source code so they can maintain it, extend it.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
Did you ever see that happen?
I have not seen that happen once.
Oh, okay.
The complexity, I think like we were also trying to like, hey, how do we do value adds to this concept in that like, do we have to like build the code that the software vendor gives you, just make sure like it's a buildable code? Like, how do you as a buyer trust the code is actually the right code that they're giving you and it's buildable, blah, 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 right? I don't think we ever did that. I've not heard of an instance where we had to like actually build a code and somebody had to build off of that. Because, you know, it's not that easy, right? You can't just get a code and build it. Like, it's more of an insurance, but I don't think it's that easy to pull that off.
Lord help you if you have to use that insurance policy.
That's right. After that team, I actually moved into a team where Iron Mountain had was really building this enterprise data backup. So these are like really backing up data from edge devices, right? Like just, you know, they have thousands of computers. Like, you know, we had like large customers like Visa, for instance, and they would really back up all of their employees' laptop into us, into the cloud, right? Mm-hmm. And so we kind of like had this concept of cloud storage before that became like a household name, really. That team, like, you know, it was a great product. It was called Connected. And so, you know, I got moved into that team from this technology escrow team. And we were trying to rewrite the entire product in a modern stack. You know, the old legacy product was written in C++, and like we had our own file archival formats and all of that stuff. And so we kind of wanted to really make it more of a, you know, kind of API based backend. And the reason for that was, you know, back in those days, the data was more of, you know, backup specifically was more of an insurance to companies, right? Either for regulations or they just want to store it because in case you lose the laptop or, you know, some important files get deleted. But it's really like, I would say 99% optimized to store and maybe 1% to retrieve, right? Nobody really just say, oh gosh, my laptop is like gone. Like, give me, put the whole from the backup, right? No, that happened, but not, you know, very slim use cases. And while companies like Dropbox were really looking at, you know, kind of this data as more from a collaboration perspective, that's where kind of the Google Docs of the world, like you creating a document and it's, they don't get emailed, you just send the link and multiple people work on the same document. And so I think for us, as you know, Iron Mountain was, that was the kind of the next growth phase. But the problem was, our software is not built for retrieval. It was kind of built for more backup. Now, how do you change that? And we kind of like putting band-aids and building APIs to retrieve the files and all that. And so I think we made a decision to really rewrite that. So it's more of an kind of like an API-based system where it's easy to share the files. Somebody can, you know, read and also write. And, you know, at that phase of the company, we were kind of going through many acquisitions. Iron Mountain Digital got sold to this company called Autonomy. Funny enough, they also had acquired Xantas, who I would have joined anyway. So it was like my destiny to go to Autonomy one way or the other.
You're end up here.
Right. And then Autonomy was actually got acquired by HP. And HP at the time was this big company, right? Like it was like 300,000 employees, and it was like a large enterprise. They had all the way from laptops to all the printers, monitors, all of the hardware things that, you know, we came to love about HP, and also the servers, right? They had some big acquisitions there, like EDS and other companies, and they were like really big on like the server sector, the enterprise services. And so it was a really pretty big company. And I think what I loved about that was, you know, we got an opportunity to actually build the backup product that would be baked into HP laptops. And it was a pilot project. I mean, they sell like crazy number of laptops, like 500,000 or million laptops, something like that, you know, just around the back to school and in the holiday seasons. And so we kind of tried a pilot to bake our software into their laptops and get sold.
That sounds like a pain. That sounds like kind of like hardware, right? Like you've only got maybe a couple cycles a year to get it right.
That's correct, right? Because what happens is that, you know, the dates can't move because they literally have to ship the laptops and they have to show up on the shelves like, you know, Best Buy, Circuit City. Like, you remember Circuit City?
Oh, yeah. Rest in peace.
Right. And companies like that. And so we really had to stick to the timelines. HP had this large team testing their images that gets baked before the manufacturing cycle. In large, those teams are very distributed in the world. And so we would have to make sure our software runs really well and ship it to those guys and they bake it into their image. And then that you get tested and you don't get a lot of windows to actually fix the bugs. So you better get them right. And you could have like auto updates and all of that stuff, which we actually built in, right? Like the first time you opens, if there's an update available, the software is going to just download it and update. But you want to make sure the first time it really works well and it actually meets the scale because the HP is going to sell like thousands and thousands of laptops. You know, I think we were pretty successful. The program did not take off.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features. To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
They actually end up selling the software products to Micro Focus?
HP was very tumultuous. Like they're just going through so many things on their own. Like, you know, Meg Whitman was the CEO at the time and she was trying to like really just increase the focus for the teams. And I think I kind of agree with that approach because it was just too big and it was just on every single thing, right? Like A to Z. And so what happened was I think she decided to split the company into two. One was the HP Inc., which is really focusing on, you know, the kind of hardware side of the business, more consumer, not just hardware, but specifically on the consumer side, you know, building consumer laptops, printers, and all that cool stuff. They have the HP Enterprise, which is like, you know, building these cool servers and also the enterprise services division. And they were even within that, that was pretty big. And so they were kind of like looking for parts to break and sell. And they ended up selling that to a company called Micro Focus. And I had like no idea who Micro Focus was. Like, I was like, what do you guys do? And they apparently had a large footprint of servicing COBOL. I think they still do. And they make a lot of money off of that. That's great for them.
Yeah, I think like hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Right. So yeah, at the time, I remember it was like 300 million or something like that. And I was frankly very surprised. But that's, you know, they have a kind of different business model. That's kind of when I realized like time to call it quits. It was almost like 10 years I was there. I've learned quite a bit, like loved my team, but I, you know, I was ready for other challenges. And I ended up going to this company called QuickBase.
What do you end up doing there?
So while I was like, you know, last few years of HP, you know, I got an opportunity to manage the team. And so that's when I kind of changed from my principal engineer role into an engineering manager. Very hands-on. I really loved the kind of re-architecting the product from the legacy systems to building, you know, kind of like a very latest technology, runs on cloud. We were looking at different options. And so we were running it on Swift. And I think like, you know, at the time we were looking at like all those distributed technologies, leveraging HBase for database and OpenStack for the cloud. So I kind of really loved that aspect. And so this opportunity came along and I found out that they were kind of doing the same in that they were re-architecting their legacy product, and QuickBase was part of Intuit, right? Hence the name, all this Quick comes in, like Quick and QuickBase, QuickBooks. And so I think they were trying to really re-architect and rebuild their product, QuickBase specifically, into to just handle the scale. And they were kind of on the journey to build this API-based economy, if you will. And someone just phoned me there, and I went that. And unfortunate for me, you know, this acquisitions and mergers continued along, you know, became a private equity company. The leadership felt that we don't necessarily need to re-architect and rebuild everything because the current product really works. So that was was not my game, and because I was specifically hired to build teams and to kind of rebuild the legacy systems. And I ended up moving to another company, and that was DraftKings.
DraftKings. This is back when they're doing mostly daily fantasy type stuff.
Yes. When I was hired there, I was managing the merchandising and acquisition teams. And so they were focusing on daily fantasy sports. But and then, you know, there was like this whole really waiting for the ruling on sports gaming. So the PASPA laws, they're literally waiting to hear from New Jersey any day. And so, and when we waited that for a year or two, I remember. And I'm a big sports fan. So really, really, that was very enticing to me to go there. And I loved the job.
Yeah, you're a Patriots fan, right?
Yeah, I'm a big Patriots fan. I my friends tell me that, you know, I came to the country, like, you know, the last two decades was like the best time for sports in Boston, and we've won so many championships, and I hope we continue that.
I think we've had an embarrassment of riches for the past two decades.
That's
and
true.
It's going to get a little tougher.
It is going to get tougher, and we'll see though. Maybe the quarterback might be playing really well.
Right on. Now, I think one of their innovations was like in-game drafting, where you could draft every quarter.
And right. So when I was managing the teams, I was put in charge to build a team to build in-game kind of drafting. And we would just kind of draft. It's more like a Yahoo mock draft for like fantasy sports, if you will, that we would build a mobile application, which is like real-time drafting enabled. So we would like every quarter, based on the current game and the score and the conditions, we would really just create these ratings and for players and assign values. And as you know, that, you know, we all just, the value gets assigned for a player and you have a limited budget. So taking that concept to really make that, like, how do we just create these players available for draft that's every quarter? And that was an interesting concept. And, you know, I've worked with some of the best engineers and product guys while we were building it. They're really sharp. And in general, I think the thing I really loved about DraftKings was the energy level the team had and the smart people that are working to build this. And they were all very passionate sports fan. That was just like a win-win situation for people.
It seems like, you know, as soon as they got that ruling where they could do sports betting, they went after that. And now I've seen even like, yeah, you could bet on the Patriots game, but they also want like each bet, you know, if they can balance the wins and losses and then just take the fig on it, they want people making more bets. So they're they're doing in-game bets now. Like, you know, will this person have more than three completions in the second quarter?
They definitely evolved that. It's a complex setup system. And the thing that I didn't realize as much when I was there is that that's all heavily regulated. Sports and Gaming Commission, right? Like, has a lot of rules and what you can do, what you can't do. And it was also a lot of complex systems. You think about it, you get a lot of money from your customers and you have to pay them out. So you're almost like a bank in that sense. There's just a lot of transaction that needs to happen, along with, you know, the kind of these regulations from, you know, just making sure, you know, the gambling aspect of things. You have to have control so people can set limits, and, you know, you can easily get carried away and just like start spending a lot of money. you know, it's the scale was pretty high. You know, I would actually, like, when the game starts in the first game of the season, we typically, like, you know, the people who are running teams and the technology experts would go to, like, the office, and we have this kind of, like, everybody watching the scale and the traffic, because we would have, you know, built a lot of features up until that point. And obviously NFL is the biggest sports for DraftKings. At the time, I'm assuming it's still the same. And in that, so we want to, like, make sure everything is good. And the first weeks are typically just crazy volume, like 11 to 1 p.m. on Sundays. Like, you know, we are, like, literally just, like, our eyes are fixed on our dashboards, like, what's going on? Are people ready to really just jump in and fix if that's, you know, something is ever going to break?
So you move on from there to Zipcar, right?
Yeah. So I went to Zipcar. And so somebody who was at QuickBase also moved to Zipcar, Jeff Pruce, and he's kind of really one of my mentors when I was there. Zipcar is just a kind of completely different from DraftKings, right? More of a very mission-oriented company. Really, you know, the people, you know, all of our coworkers really cared about the mission of a green earth and, like, urban development and reducing the traffic and all of that, you know, great stuff, right? We just had a entirely different challenges there, because it's a very sophisticated system in that, you know, we built technology that goes into our cars, and where the telematics, all the sensors that we built would, you know, really get all of this data from cars and constantly communicating to our backend. And so it was a sophisticated system, and we built, like, the mobile apps and backend systems and websites. You know, people were really great. I actually learned quite a bit while I was at Zipcar.
One thing you learned is that Zipcars tend to get used heavily on the weekends in cities, but not so much midweek. So what do they do?
We had this product called Commuter, right? And Zipcars are quite heavily used. A lot of people rely on Zipcar going places, and especially if you're living in the cities and you don't want to own a car, which is most of the times is the case, because you don't have a place to park, right? And it's not easy to maintain a car. The car gets used heavily during the weekends. Like, how do you really just increase the utilization for during the week? That's a, you know, coupled along with the challenges, because when, you know, the year after I started there, the pandemic hit. I think I've learned most the first few months of the pandemic in my professional career than the entire time before. And I say that because it's not just the technological challenges, but it's also, like, you know, we were not doing well, right? I mean, if people can't drive and they're locked down, Zipcar can't make money, right? And so I've learned a lot outside of software development on how to really improve the organization and how to be very effective, how to, like, really negotiate for, you know, all the contracts that we are paying. So to really just reduce our spending. And I was actually hired as a director of engineering there. And I was running the kind of more consumer facing teams, like their mobile apps, their websites, also the data engineering teams and, like, the backend services that are powering them. And my boss, who was the head of engineering, ended up leaving within very short time of the pandemic, in a couple of months. You know, I was given the opportunity to lead the engineering organization. And, you know, I've learned not only just, you know, how to manage the entire organization, but how to, like, really collaborate with other teams, other divisions to, like, think of the bigger picture. And, you know, I was kind of thrown into this to really just make sure that how are we, like, you know, survive and then really grow during the pandemic. And at the time that, you know, I was, like, kind of looking for other opportunities and really just to go to a different industry where, you know, I can be just, you know, very valuable. And this someone who used to work with me in a brief time at Zipcar actually referred to me this company called Wellframe. And so that's where I'm currently am at. Wellframe is an awesome place. Wellframe is a health tech company, and Wellframe actually builds, you know, really this great mobile experiences for members, right? So if you're a health plan, you're really focusing on a lot of optimization and providing the best care for your members, but you don't have the kind of the technology platform to provide, you know, this care management for your members, right? And that's kind of where we come in, and we build the software to enable the health plans to provide a best member experience. So the members get, you know, great experience, great care. They have like more personalized care for them. At the same time, the health plans really keep their members healthy. And so they are, you know, kind of improving their operational efficiency. Everybody wins. And so that's what I love about this company. Similar to Zipcar in that, you know, work on a mission that really touches people's lives. I mean, that's really validating for anybody that if you can make that level of contribution.
I noticed another theme, though. There's at least three jobs where because you stayed in touch with and stayed friendly with people from your network, that you found those jobs because of keeping that network active. So definitely a very important thing to do.
Absolutely. And I still feel that, like, you know, as an engineering leader, if also people follow you, that's really just kind of validating, you know, that your management style to some extent. Yes, obviously, you know, you can tap into network, you're going to get people. Pretty much everybody does that. But it's important that you are, you know, looked up and just people would love to work with you more than once. Like, I've hired people more than three times. I take a lot of pride in that.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely a testament to you if people want to work with you again and again and again by choice.
Absolutely.
Are there any hobbies you're into when you're not banging away at the keyboard?
So I play a music instrument. It's a Indian percussion instrument. It's from southern India. It's called mridangam. That's an instrument you kind of play on both sides. I don't know if you heard something called tabla, which is kind of like a very similar instrument in that you have two pieces of drums that you're playing. Mridangam is just a kind of one drum and you play on both sides. You know, that kind of relaxes me. Like, you know, even during like when I have 5 minutes, 10 minutes here and there during the day, I keep it right next to me. And, you know, if you're on a video call, you'll probably see that sitting next to me because I just take a break and then play. You know, back in the days, you didn't know, like, before the pandemic, like, people are not used to video, like, what they can see. Like, now, like, hey, no, I mean, I'm proud to show that, like, you know, I play this instrument, this part of me, and that relaxes me. So I don't mind like keeping it like that.
You should play it during meetings.
Yeah, I've seen so many people have like a piano in their background, and we used to like just joke about, like, you know, I actually gonna play piano to improve the productivity of the meetings.
Now, I noticed you're wearing a shirt that says Unite for Bleeding Disorders. Is this a charity that you're interested in?
Yeah, so my daughter has a medical condition. You know, I'm kind of active in that community for bleeding disorders. And we usually have a walk every year for a New England Hemophilia Association. We have been doing that because of the pandemic, but that's something that a cause that I'm very passionate about. I'm actually on a technology committee for some of these organizations myself and try to really give back to the community in every possible way I can.
Very cool. Well, we will publish some show notes for the show. And in there, if you'd like, we can include a link to the walk and any fundraising that you do for the charity.
Absolutely. I would really appreciate that.
We encourage people to check out the show notes. They're on our website, underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio, where you can find links to this episode and all our previous episodes of Underserved. Madhu, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed our discussion.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.